On this episode, we talk to a professor who is flipping his classroom, turning it upside down, and doing things in a creative way. And we're also going to ask the question, what is in your hand at the very end? So put your thinking caps on. Here we go.
You are listening to the Rebel Storytellers podcast.
Rebel Storytellers.
Candid conversations with dreamers, doers, and creative problem solvers.
Hosted by Brad Wise and Steve Fuller.
A wee podcast made in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Any interesting stories from your school lad days?
I have a lot, but let me start at the beginning. My very first day of school, it's a true story. I got on the bus, and I was so upset about having to go to school. I didn't want to go to school. And so I cried. And I remember crying like the whole bus ride. And when our bus turned the corner and everyone saw our school, Brantner Elementary School, everyone on the bus cheered because they were super excited about going to school. And I was sitting there like crying. And the first day of school, I loved. I had the greatest day of my life. I loved school. And so the second day of school, when the bus turned the corner, I started cheering and everybody else on the bus just sat there.
Yeah.
So I feel like I was the only person at Brantner Elementary in kindergarten that actually liked school after the first day.
Uh-huh.
And I was so mad at myself because the first day of school, I wasted my opportunity to cheer. And the second day of school, I was the only person cheering.
did they call you old, like, here comes old Cheery.
Old Cheery McFuller.
Here comes old, doesn't know when to say cheers the right time.
Yeah.
Steve.
And I had a string of little events like that throughout school. Like I remember I got a really good grade in kindergarten one time, whatever grades they give you, like a smiley face or whatever. And I was so excited. This will explain a lot of my personality. I was so excited that I wrote check marks all over my paper. Because I was so proud of myself. So just like 1,000 check marks on my paper. And then when I was done, I looked at it and I realized I ruined the paper with all of my check marks.
Uh-huh.
And so I got really sad and cried.
Oh my God.
Because this is like my first good assignment. And I was so proud of it that I just went crazy with my own check marks. And then at the end, I realized I had ruined the assignment. And there's some deep psychological thing there.
You've been sort of a psychopath for a long time.
It's really weird. There's some message in there, right? It's like if you love
yourself.
Right, too much. And if you love yourself too much, you end up ruining the good part of you that you loved in the first place.
I bet if you made a bunch of perfect check marks and perfect tiny little rows, then you would have, like, your head would have exploded. You would have had to, like, go home and ask your mom for new wallpaper so you can check mark everything. That's what would have happened.
I think that was the start of it all, the start of me.
So in this episode, we're kind of talking about teaching and education in innovative ways. Do you want to hear – I have a story from when I was in seventh grade.
I do. Last time I jokingly said no,
but we all knew.
I can't do that joke again.
Right.
So yes, Brad, I would love to hear.
In seventh grade, I was taking health class with Mr. Price, and we had to write a paper. And in school – whenever I could get away with it, instead of writing a paper, which was boring, I would ask the teachers if I could make a video instead of a – and most teachers, because they were boring and not innovative, wouldn't let me do that.
But not Mr. Price.
Not Mr. Price. He was the best. And so I made a video, and my report was supposed to be on steroids, and so I read all about steroids. And then I recorded this video where I dressed up in different characters and described what – steroids does to you. So obviously I did like the muscle one, you know, so I put a bunch of towels in my sweatshirts and I was kind of Hans and Franz-ish and even had an Austrian accent and just talked about my huge, you know, pecs. Then I remember back then reading about how your testicles shrink.
Wow, that I wasn't expecting that.
You weren't expecting me to say testicles?
No, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah. So your testicles shrink when you do steroids. So the character for that was I dressed up
yourself. you played the role of yourself.
Oh, gosh. I set myself up without knowing it. No, I dressed up as a woman. And so for my wig, I wore a pom-pom, like a plastic, like red pom-pom, and that was my hair. And I put like little socks in a whatchamacallit? And
a bra?
Yeah. And I just talked about how small my testicles were now. And then I dressed up as a doctor and I talked about, you know, the medical side of things. And I even had like three different like scenes in my house. And I tell you what, it was the
what grade did you get on this?
I got like a what's above an A?
A plus?
Yeah. I got an A plus.
Did you really?
Yeah. It was good. It was all like good information. And he, for years to come, I don't know if he's still teaching, but he would show people that video and say, if you want to do something different for your report, you can. Here's something that this super genius did.
This is a very important question.
Okay.
I want you to think about this.
All right.
Does that video still exist?
Oh, man. It may.
Because I would pay a lot of money to see you dressed up in all these outfits.
Yeah.
Doing this little Bradwise educational video.
It's probably it's a pretty special thing to see.
Where is it?
It might be at my parents' house.
Might be. Check on this.
I'll ask my parents. So we're going to talk to Michael Sharp, professor at UC, here in a little bit. And he's a super innovative professor, and he's got some cool things to say. But first,
we have a word from our sponsor.
That's right. Today's episode is brought to you by my wife's hatred of these segments.
Your wife's hatred of these segments. When you're doing something really cool and creative that you're proud of, but your wife tells you they stink.
Is your self-esteem doing pretty good? Do you want to kick down a notch? Talk to your wife. Talk to my wife.
Yeah, talk to Brad's wife. But you love your wife.
I do. I feel like I should say something nice, but that would kill. That sponsor paid for this segment, so.
We're just reading copy. We don't have any control over what we say.
Let's hear from Michael.
So, Mike, you do something called a flip classroom.
That's correct.
And I know a little bit about that because I'm in the teaching world, but a lot of our listeners probably don't. Can you sum up in a few sentences what is a flipped classroom?
Yeah. The flipped classroom is sort of a philosophy of teaching or an approach to teaching that basically intentionally disrupts the expert-novice relationship that traditional classrooms often have. And so, you know, if you went to school in the last three decades, what you probably remember is sitting in a classroom, not saying very much, maybe taking some notes, and there'd be a professor in the front of the room, sometimes behind a podium, the sage on the stage that would say a lot of words, and you'd write some of those words down and try to remember as many of those words and lessons later as possible so that you get a good grade in the class.
That sounds fun.
Not very fun at all.
It's like I'm having a flashback. This is what's happening right
Yeah.
now.
And so, you know, and this didn't happen for me overnight. This happened over a decade of teaching and sort of slowly giving up control and giving up power in the classroom and giving that to the students. And so sort of what I say to them at the beginning of the term now is that you know, we call this the flipped classroom or constructivist classroom. And I say that I am an expert, but it's in a very small amount of things. But the rest of you sitting in the classroom are experts also. And so I'm not going to pretend that the relationship here is a one-way relationship where I'm depositing knowledge into your brains. Rather, I'm starting from the assumption that if we all bring our expertise and experiences to the learning environment, that we will learn some stuff. And so from the very beginning, I empower students to be active teaching and learning members of the class.
Sometimes I mock you because it just sounds funny to me. You teach a class called Introduction to Rhetorical Theory, and you have what are called rhetorical walkabouts.
Yes.
Explain what a rhetorical walkabout is?
Well, it's basically many field trips that we do periodically throughout the term. And, you know, if you know anything about rhetoric, you sort of know that everything is rhetorical. Everything that we see, everything that we say, everything that we do, one could argue that it's rhetorical.
How so? What do you mean by
well,
that?
Well, so if you imagine sitting in front of Starbucks coffee, you could sit there for 30 minutes and see a lot of rhetoric happening. You could see people talking to one another. You could see the advertising that Starbucks uses to get people to stop in there. Rhetoric is everywhere that we are and everywhere that we look. And so, you know, depending on the week, the rhetorical walkabouts are framed as questions. And I'll say something like, what does rhetoric sound like? And so the students are charged with going out and listening to rhetoric. Another week may be, what does rhetoric look like? And they're charged with going out and observing it. What does rhetoric smell like and taste like and feel like? And so it's getting at some pretty simple questions that...
Are you feeling lost right now? Like, what the heck is rhetoric? Yeah, I was too. So I'm feeling kind of dumb right now, because when you say rhetoric...
Aren't you used to that?
To me, like, a rhetorical question
yeah.
is an open-ended question that's not supposed to be answered.
Yeah.
But when you say walking around and seeing rhetoric, like, you asking those questions just there of what does it look like, smell like,
mm-hmm.
like, I want you to answer that yeah. in case there's any other, maybe there's three other dumb people like me who can't understand what you're saying right now.
Yeah. So let's stick with what does rhetoric smell like? I think that's an interesting one, because people typically don't, you know, equate smelling or that sense with rhetoric.
And so the professor here does his Jedi flip class mind game thing and doesn't give me just what I want, a definition of a word that I kind of sort of thought I understood, but now I'm feeling like I have to go on a 3-month walkabout in the Crocodile Dundee jungle to figure it out.
Now, the trick is, Brad, that there isn't a standard definition of rhetoric. They're all over the board. And so my definition of rhetoric is probably different than Steve's. It has a whole lot to do with, you know, truth and power. And it has a whole lot to do with meaning, who gets to control the meaning. So, for example, we go through a little exercise with wooden tables and red carpets. And I sort of set up this hypothetical scenario where I show a picture of a wooden table on the overhead, and we have a really short conversation about what is that thing. And people always say, well, that's a table. And well, what kind of things do we do with a table or around the table? And so we come up with a list of things like we have dinner, we do homework, et cetera. And then I do the same thing with a picture of a red carpet. And I say, what is that thing? And we go through the same exercise. And then I tell sort of a hypothetical fictional story where if we were to get on a helicopter and pick these items up and in the quiet of night find maybe the last untouched by modern man tribe left in the Amazon jungle. And while they're all sleeping in their dwellings, we sort of, in the middle of their tribe, drop those items off and then hide in the bushes and watch. What do they do in the morning, right? And so that we have a discussion about what these people wake up and do. And what we know that they don't do is wake up and say, oh, look, it's a table and a carpet. And so we sort of just brainstorm and get creative with what could they use these things for. And we say all kinds of things, like some people may use it as firewood, or some people may use it as shelter, or some people may think it's a gift from the gods and worship it. And that gets us to the fundamental question of, well, we call that thing a table, but if it's used as firewood in this tribe, is it still a table or is it firewood? And that sort of gets us thinking about who gets to define terms, who has the power to define things.
Yeah, and I would, the difference, you know, back when I was in college, so this was
1940s.
1995 to 99. So when I took rhetorical theory, I had a pretty well-known scholar in our field, Rudy Vertebra,
yeah.
as my professor. And I remember that he essentially forced us to memorize a definition of rhetoric. And it was the faculty of observing in any given situation the available means of persuasion.
That's Aristotle's definition of rhetoric.
Want to hear that definition again?
The faculty of observing in any given situation the available means of persuasion. Now, I enjoyed Dr. Vertebrer. I liked his class. But that seems like the exact opposite, right? Where there is a definition that exists in the world and you're forced to memorize and regurgitate that thing versus discovering for yourself, what does this word mean?
Could he have been – that was a form of rhetoric, right? Of him – he had the power and he was directing the meaning. So was he making sort of like a meta point?
Exactly.
I want to pause right here and tell you how proud I was of this moment. I kind of, sort of, finally figured out what rhetoric is. I slept soundly that night.
So the other hat that you wear at UC is service learning and civic engagement. Generally speaking, it's a class partnering with a community partner, mm-hmm. almost always not-for-profit.
Right.
And then the community partner has some sort of project that they need done, mm-hmm. something they need help with. And then the class partners with them to do that thing. Mm-hmm. And in the process, the real-world experience helps that class learn better than if they're just reading from a textbook, hearing lectures.
Exactly.
So one of Mike's classes is teaming up with part of the Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville, Kentucky, called Generation Ali. And Generation Ali is a series of initiatives and projects that empower young people to find their voice and become leaders in social justice issues. So essentially, Generation Ali and Mike's service learning classes share the same exact DNA. They are both changing the world around them by getting young folks to discover their purpose and then use it in the service of others.
In a good service learning class, all that's really happening is you're giving students the opportunity to do what humans like to do, which is to be in community, to live meaningful lives, to do meaningful things, and to help one another. We are, you know, I often say in class that humans are pack animals, and we're built for that. That's what we're built to do. And this approach is just giving students the opportunity to do that with the added benefit of whatever it is that they're at the university trying to learn, they are using those new tools to do that service. So if a student comes to the university to learn engineering, I mean, that's a very valuable skill or a very valuable program to be involved in. Now, if you give that same student the opportunity to use engineering skills and build a house for Habitat for Humanity or build dwellings in Haiti or et cetera, students see the value of what they're being taught and they're applying it in pretty natural ways. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I imagine your students are more alive in your classroom than, say, Fuller's classroom.
Hey,
well,
now.
That goes without saying.
Wait a second. Well, but the other thing, too, is it's not easy. You know, I do service learning classes, too, and it's hard to affect change.
Yeah.
Right? Because people just want to do what they've always done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the trick to that is, if you tell people that they have to do it, they won't do it. If you sort of show people why they should do it and sort of let them own that, this gets back to the flip classroom idea, and they own it, then they'll do it willingly and do it really well.
Right. And it's always you have to get through that first hard part in order to get to the soft, chewy center, right?
The word that comes to mind for me is satisfying or satisfaction. And people start on creative journeys because at the end of the day, they want that feeling. But with the first brushstroke or the first action scene or whatever you're going to say, it's not satisfying yet, but it's the anticipation of that. And at the end, it's worth it. On the front end, it's hard. It's like, I'm never going to finish this. This is way too much. But at the end, you do, and you're really satisfied.
Yep, and we're out of time.
That was a perfect ending. Yeah. That was awesome.
Thanks, Michael Sharp.
You're very welcome.
For our last segment, we're going to play the ending of Joe Boyd's one-man show Exodus that just wrapped at the Freedom Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. He told the story of Moses, and he did it on a stage with nothing more than a chair and a tree limb that we fashioned into a staff. And so, spoiler alert, this is the end charge that he gave the audience, and I think you'll find it's very similar to what Professor Sharp is charging his students to do. Enjoy.
What if the point of the story, or at least one of them, is that you can't get yourself free? No matter how bad you want it, you on your own, you just can't do it. The people who escaped here on the banks of the Ohio River, they were courageous and they risked everything, but they could not have done it alone. There was an underground railroad that got them here. There were people of all races, religions, helping them cross the line. There were people that took the sticks and stones that they had in their hands and they built something, or they used them to help others get free. And in the process, if you ask those people who helped, you might hear them say, "That's how I got my freedom, by helping someone else get free." I wonder if we all aren't called to be less like the people of Israel and a little more like Moses. Where there's something in our life that's burning, and it has been for a while. It didn't go out. It should have gone out, but it's still here. Something in our heart that's burning and burning and burning, and it just won't go away. And we've been afraid to take that dangerous walk just a few yards over to see what it is. But we know deep down, we know there's something in us that is saying, come here, do this. And we have a hunch that there's something in that that will help others somehow, will help them be free. And we need to trust that though it makes not a lot of sense, that if we help others get free, that we will find our own freedom. And at the end of the story, we might even be glowing and radiant. But you have to have the courage to see that slow burn that burns in your heart year after year after year, and to not ignore it, and to realize there are things that need to be done to set people free, physical, real things that need to be done. And we have the courage to walk over to the bush, and you have no idea where it's going to lead you. You have no idea the words you're going to hear, but you all hear the same words. We all will hear the same words, and it will sound something like this: "Moses, Moses, my son, draw them out, my daughter, draw them out, draw them out." And we'll ask enough questions, and we'll spend enough time in the burning, and then we will hear the question that Moses heard: "What's in your hand? What's in your hand?" And it won't be a stick, but it'll be something. What's in your hand? What's in your bank account? What's in your house? What is in your realm of power to control? What skill sets do you have? What knowledge do you have? What's in your hand? It is that which is in all of our hands, which when we could all agree to use to set others free, that they will be free. This is the story of every great freedom movement that has ever happened in the history of the world, where normal people take what's in their hands and they leverage it to see others be free. And at the end of it, those who gave will tell you that they were slaves before and didn't realize it, but in the process of using what's in their hands, that they became free. And there is a glow about those people that you are lucky enough to bump into from time to time. And deep down you know they've experienced something. They've experienced freedom.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for pressing play. My name is Brad Wise. My co-host is Professor Steve Fuller. Thanks to Jim Zartman of Talkie Records for making all of our music. Thanks to the rhetorical Mike Sharp for learning us. And if you haven't subscribed yet to the podcast, you should, and you can via iTunes. If you're anywhere close to Cincinnati, you should also get tickets to the four-letter word show KISS, coming on February 13th. Go to rebelstorytellers.com. You can see all of our blogs, events, past episodes, and more. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, keep creating.